Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. 411 Teen consists of four teens with diverse political affiliations. The panel seeks to maintain a substantive political dialogue, analyzing and evaluating national, state, and local politics. So let's tap into the pulse of young folks this hour. And remember, common sense may not always be common. Joining me here at the round table, I welcome three IB students. Glad to have Shonda Dina Day-Allen.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad to have you back. I've missed you for a while. Ken Bamani, his thing is chemistry and history and geography.
Glad to be here.
And Hannah Kiros. Hannah is into computer science and biology.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, over 1,000 places have names that dot the American landscape that may be offensive. Francis Epps, the declared founder of Florida State University, was a wealthy slave owner and grandson of Thomas Jefferson. He also was a founding member of St. John's Episcopal Church Mission in 1829, and it was built by slaves in 1837. In 1995, under President D'Alembert, Florida State University established the Jefferson Epps Trophy to honor Epps and his grandfather, Thomas Jefferson. A statue was installed to commemorate him at FSU. In October 2016, the statue was the subject of a removal referendum introduced by the Students for a Democratic Society because Francis Epps was a slave owner. There have been a number of issues concerning Francis Epps. Wednesday, September 6, 2017, Tallahassee Democrat front page. Thrasher orders review of FSU's statues. SDS, Students for Democratic Society, are seeking the removal of the statue of Francis Epps near the Westcott Building on FSU's campus. President Thrasher has ordered a review of statues, markers, and name recognitions in light of the movement across the country to remove Confederate designations. My opening question to you is how important is it that we understand our history?
I think it's funny. That's a question that my history professor at Rickards, Mr. Matthew Harrington, posed to our class.
Oh, okay.
I think on within the first week of school,
mm-hmm.
Because we're learning about the antebellum South and the memory of the Confederacy is so integral to Southern identity, and I think it's important to view all historical characters in the context of their times, because I'm sure that there are things that we consider acceptable today that will be taboo and awful and evil in, like, I don't know, 20, 30 years even. So I think it's important to, I mean, I definitely hate all slave. Everyone can agree that owning slaves is like a despicable thing to engage within, but I feel like you have to view the person within a broader context. Like if you take, let's say, Robert E. Lee or Jefferson Davis, it's very clear that a large part of their identity was, you know, wrapped around perpetuating the practice of slavery and defending it. So I think with those people, it's easier to say that, you know, there's no place for celebrating them within the American psyche. But if you take people like Jefferson or Washington, you consider them within the scope of their other accomplishments. So let's say Jefferson, I think he's the founding father that's the most famous for owning slaves and treating them awfully. But you also have to consider the fact that he wrote the Declaration of Independence and that he was integral to defining American ideals of democracy. And I think that is a larger contribution.
So what I hear you saying is that it's really contextual.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you agree, Shonda, or what do you think?
I agree with Hannah. It depends on how you look at it and which way history has kind of leaned towards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder, and I'm willing, and I know when I learned that, I was pretty devastated. But,
but it also was the times.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I'm not defending it.
I get it. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to be all, I mean, of course, maybe mm-hmm. he's a founding father. He should have forethought, you know? Mm-hmm. But he didn't, and I mean, now if someone had slaves, obviously. But
and there are places that slaves still exist.
But
and some would say that, you know, slavery has not gone. It's just evolved.
I guess, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, it's a reflection of that time period. And I don't think I can say that. I don't think they're who they are and how they are looked at in history should change because of that. I don't know. That's what I think.
Yeah, I agree. The founding fathers, their owning of slaves is overlooked because of every other thing they've done for the country. I mean, founding the country, setting the mm-hmm. basis for the country and all that. But when it comes to the Confederate generals and politicians and stuff, you kind of look at them and see that them and slavery are two inseparable things. And it's definitely not a lie to say that they believed in slavery and they partook in slavery. But at the same time, they also did a lot of different things. And although they had their own achievements, you know, in establishing a nation, it's undeniable that what they did was in the name of slavery. And I think that to them, they were justified. To themselves, they were justified. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can't just say that they're that the statues to them and or just like, I mean, it's a to commemorate a memory, and we are a product of our history, you know, and this is our history right there, the monuments, and I don't think that really they should be taken down or defaced or anything like that.
Can we understand our history without idolizing figures who were racist?
I think so. I think what I would prefer that the place for Confederate monuments to be in the U.S. is within museums, or okay. if they're
national,
I think so. That we also had this discussion in history class. I think there's nothing wrong with commemorating Civil War battlegrounds, and there's nothing wrong with continuing to study Confederate generals, because it would be wrong to erase them mm-hmm. from history entirely. But there are certain parts of your culture that I think you should acknowledge but not celebrate. And I think mm-hmm. that through creating statues and monuments to slave owners and people that just have that are very closely associated with some of the most vile parts of American history, I think that's wrong, because when you celebrate them, you're associating your national identity with them, and you're showing pride in what they did.
But what about those who have a national identity and understanding that what they did, again, was contextual, was acceptable at that time? Because we're looking at it from a different perspective. We're looking at it from a different time zone, right? And what and I'm just throwing that out to all of you, what impact that does that have? Shonda?
That has a huge, I mean, I know mm-hmm. that the time period and the mindset of everyone, mm-hmm. It's a huge part of the narrative.
Right.
And when you look at figures like Jefferson Davis, you can't just completely ignore them. Like, they were there. And the reason why we know them is because they played a big part of that story.
Indeed.
And you can't, like, this is going to sound dumb, but in the movie Lion King, you have Scar. right? And I hate him, but you can't ignore him. He didn't exist. He was a huge part of the story.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and you have to just take it all as a whole and just digest and move on and learn. And I don't think it's going to do anyone any good to disregard, forget, or even or idolize. And it's just you're there, and they were there, and you learn from it. And I think that's it.
Now, where do you sit on this?
I agree with Shonda. To say that you know what we have now, and with all the statues and stuff, to say that it commemorates the Confederates, but they're a part of our history too, just as much as the Union was a part of our history, and in no part smaller or greater, and. To just erase that and to forget about that and to disregard that for better or for worse, I'm saying whether you see the Confederacy in a positive or negative light, I think that's just wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is something that just, you know, shouldn't happen.
Do you think colleges should continue to honor famous founders or alumni who were indeed racist? And if so, how should they do it?
I guess if we're thinking, I'm still thinking back to the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. In my mind, Benjamin Franklin is above Thomas Jefferson because he was an abolitionist, and he was just, I think, a cooler guy in general. So I think that colleges can
I agree with you on that.
Yeah, I read his autobiography. I think it's so good. But I think that colleges can make a conscious choice to choose people that thought ahead of their time. So, like, I know William Seward was, you know, like, in a lot of trouble for being a prominent abolitionist in, like, you know, antebellum American society. So you can pick figures that, in the future at least, that didn't have such, I don't know, they didn't have shadier or just more troubled pasts.
But see, some would say that they're shady to some. It's all relative. Because it is a part of history, and not that I'm celebrating that my uncle, you know, was a slave owner, but that is a part of history, and should it just be ignored? I mean, those are some of the issues. But I have a couple more questions, and then we'll go into looking at what's happening nationally. You're tuned in to 411 Team, talking with IB students, Common Sense Team, and we're looking at political issues. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we have been looking at our historical icons that have dubious, questionable history. What steps do you think we should take to refute or de-emphasize the historical figures if they have really negative, questionable, racist views? How should we handle it? Because even though you feel like, wow, they're negative, you know, their history is not good, it sends a negative message, but they were there. They did contribute. They had something very valuable that they contribute. So how should we address it?
I don't know really how you can address it, or if you can, mm-hmm. for that matter, because a lot of the prominent Southern politicians and aristocracy were slaveholders, mm-hmm. because, you know, they get their power from their slaves, and they're rich because of their slaves, and that's how they they get on top, you know? So, and I think it's kind of impossible to look at them and separate them having slaves and being a racist and their political views. I think you have to take it, like Shonda said, like as the whole. And you have to...
Are we denying a population their heritage? Because often we look at it and say, oh, that's hate. You know, we look at the Confederate flag. But that is a part of the history.
I guess on that, I think that the civil, you can view the Confederacy like during the Civil War as engaging in an active rebellion against a national consensus, or at mm-hmm. least they're rebelling against the notion that the United States can exist while reconciling competing ideals. So I think it would be foolish for the United States to celebrate that, because we've obviously gotten past the point where, we're not debating whether secession is something that,
right. No, we've moved beyond that.
So I think it's...
I guess.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's illogical for us to idealize the Confederacy. Especially, it's done a lot of the time in the name of patriotism, which mm-hmm. I think is silly, mm-hmm. because yeah. it's... I think seceding from the Union is the most unpatriotic thing you can do.
Just about.
Yeah.
What message does it send when you see these statues? What are we saying?
It depends on your interpretation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When I see these statues, I just think of their history. It's cool. I mean, when they were put there, I hope the intention was not to promote all these bad things like slavery. Like, look at this guy. He had slaves, mm-hmm. and he is famous. I don't think that's why they're there. And now you can interpret something any way you want it to. You can have it symbolize whatever you want. And that's a problem with the people and not the statues. And I
go ahead.
I know most of the statues that were erected of Confederate generals were put up during the Civil Rights Movement, and mm-hmm. during the height of Jim Crow laws within the South. So basically, between the 1920s to I guess 1970s is when there was an uptick in erecting those statues, and it was mostly by the grandchildren of Confederate soldiers. So it's not an effort to memorialize the losses of Confederate lives during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Most statues memorializing the Confederacy were put up in a response to the Civil Rights Movement, and to just as a way to after the Lost Cause was perpetuated by a lot of Southerners, the statues went up. So I think it's mostly a civil rights issue.
What should be, then this is our last question on this, the criteria then for establishing markers or buildings or naming buildings? And I'm talking about now, currently.
I think if you're going to have something like an FSU, you have to acknowledge the other side of the story. And you can have the good, but you also need to educate people as in, this is how we got there, this is how it happened, and you have to give credit to where it's deserved and the people behind him. And mm-hmm. And I think if that's the approach we took, that would make more sense, and that would educate everyone.
I think so long as people know the difference between who they are and I'm saying as long as people are educated on the matter and who mm-hmm. these people were, already in place, there's a lot of places in town, just in town, like Calhoun Street,
mm-hmm.
named after exactly. Confederates and ex-Confederates. And so I'm saying there's not a whole lot we can change about the things in place already, but so long as people are educated and know what's going on with the situation, that it's not really going to be an issue.
I think that there should be a gradual progression against creating statues that memorialize Confederate generals and even naming streets after them. But again, I think that should be gradual, because I'm just starting to drive, and I know where Calhoun Street is. But I don't. When you're establishing the criteria for how whether a person is good enough morally to be commemorated by your state, I think that you have to do it on a case-by-case basis, because I don't think there are any, you can't say, well, this person owned, 10 slaves, but he also wrote 5 amendments to the state constitution that were very beneficial. You can't, I don't think that you can set quantitative limits to that. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to do it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. All right. Let's move on and look at what is happening in the national arena. Overall, how would you assess the Trump presidency and administration to this point?
I think he's doing, like, a remarkably bad job. Like, I think I try a lot of the time to, like, I personally don't think that he's a fantastic person, but I try to view his actions outside of that, outside of any, you know, any personal or emotional, like, bias that I may have against him. Mm-hmm. But I think that his presidency has been defined by just, like, foolishness and cruelty, especially now that he's taking away DACA, but yeah, he's doing it very, like, he's leaving 800,000 people in such ambiguity by saying, oh, we'll remove DACA, and then but Congress will try to put something in place, but we don't know if that will actually occur because they've been working on something similar for years.
And now he has also said that, and if Congress doesn't do it, then he will revisit it.
Yeah, and I think that's really emblematic of the fact that he has no idea what he's doing, and while he's learning, a lot of people's lives are being, you know, upheaved, and it's like you can't have a learning curve for the presidency, you know. Like I think that all of the decisions that he's making, especially foreign policy ones that kind of freak me out, they have consequences, and you can tell that there's not really a strict agenda. Everything's in disarray.
Okay. What's your reading on it?
I think it's just ignorance. Like, there's so much. There's no empathy at all. When I watched Jeff Sessions deliver the news, it didn't seem like it was going to wreck almost a million of people my age, like their lives, their families.
800,000.
When Trump, he kind of shied away from delivering the news, I think he's just starting to understand the significance of what's happening.
So you do think he's starting to understand?
I think he's starting to, because if not, he would be like, I'm keeping my promise, look at me, I'm destroying DACA. Like, that's what he said on his campaign.
Yes, he did. It was a campaign promise, yes.
So, but he's not really stepping out and taking full credit for that like he would, like, I don't know, when he did the Muslim ban or something like that.
Yeah, what do you think?
It's not as disastrous as I thought it would be. But on the matter of DACA, I think that, I mean, the students are, you know, they're a product of U.S. taxpayer money now. They're foreigners taken in by the U.S. government to get an education while they're here. And a lot of them have become qualified. I mean, some of them are like 24, 25 now, qualified workers, and all funded by U.S. taxpayer money. And like they've said, almost a million people. That is a lot of people. And just to, you know, expel them at our own expenditure. I mean, these people have lived here for their whole lives, basically. They've essentially U.S. citizens. So to send them back to their own country, would honestly, that'd be America's loss, and that would be Trump's loss as well.
And I don't know what their own country is, because we're talking about individuals who were brought here. Mm-hmm. They had no say in it, and some of them were brought here as babies. Mm-hmm. I'll get right to you. They were brought here as babies, so they had no control. Mm-hmm. Why should they be punished? And as a group, they're much more productive. Mm-hmm. They've had to be productive mm-hmm. to adhere to the restrictions and requirements of DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I know you had a comment, so go on.
I guess on the matter of being brought here by your parents, I know if my mother says, let's go to the Olive Garden, you know, there's no debate. And even so, like,
right. Yeah, exactly.
If your parents are, this is obviously a much more extreme example,
right.
But if your parents are taking you somewhere, especially I think it's 16 and under, so even if you're, I think, 17 to 18, you have a bit more autonomy, at least I hope, because I'm getting there.
But we're not talking about that.
These children,
those are not the, overall, those are not the individuals we're talking about.
Yeah.
People came at one, they came at three mm-hmm. or five, so.
So I think it's foolish to penalize people that were subject to their parents' whim. It's not as if they, you know, they chose to become an mm-hmm. illegal immigrant. And I also think that it's very strange that this, you can tell, I think the reason why he's shying away from this issue a bit is because there was moderate Republican support for DACA. So there's, and I think that that's emblematic of the fact that he's catering to a very, very small portion of the Republican Party, and it seems as if he's trying to only appease his base rather than the Republican majority, which is, so I think that's, you know, that's why he's been a bit more timid with it, because he knows that there are members of his own party that are likely to oppose him.
You know, when he announced this, demonstrations erupted all across the country, D.C., Chicago, L.A. Do you feel that protests have any impact on his decision-making?
Trump's decision-making?
Yes.
No, I don't think they do, but I think they impact the public, and I think they do spread awareness. And I think that maybe one day we'll somehow get to him, and maybe he'll listen. But, I mean, I think when people go out and protest, their goal is not, like, if they're protesting, they probably know that Trump's not going to listen right now.
Mm-hmm.
But their goal is to, like, show that, look, these are real people, and you're affecting these real people, and or I'm with you, and you have support, and don't feel alone, something like that. So, I mean, I don't think they should stop protesting. I think you should definitely...
So there is need for protest.
Yes, yes.
You support protest.
I guess I disagree a little bit. I think the protests actually do get to him, because he wants to view himself as... he ran as a populist president, so if popular support is, like, completely against the agenda that he's trying to perpetuate, then that's going to, you know, harm his ego and harm his sense of self and identity. And I think the reason why there's been such intense protests is because the people who have who are a part of the DACA program, they went from being undocumented to putting their trust in the fact that the government would take care of them. And suddenly that's taken away, and now their names are on a list, which is so scary, because if you're scared about the prospect of deportation, you went from no one knowing who you were and the fear of being sought out to knowing that everyone is aware that you're an undocumented immigrant.
Comments?
I don't really have much more to say than what they have.
Okay.
I think for, like, protests and Trump, you know, I don't think it's really getting to him too much. But I do think that protests are a very good idea, and I think they should be, I mean, as an extension of freedom of speech, should be protected under any president.
When he announced that he was rescinding DACA, what was the message? How did people, in your opinion, respond to this? I mean, what was he saying by doing that? I'm looking at all of you, so whoever wants to respond.
I don't think he was saying anything different from what he was saying before.
Mm-hmm.
But the response was huge. I was not aware what DACA was before this happened.
Okay.
And I read into it, and now I know it, and now it... I can't imagine being one of those kids or one of those families.
Can you imagine that?
I can't. I don't even want to think about that. And I don't know how they're dealing with it. But after this was announced, on my Instagram feed, there was literally so much. There were poems. There were people. Everything was DACA related. And I thought, like, the entire world seems so upset over it. And I just don't understand why they do something like this.
I think it's a big deal, because you have a group of people that were protected by the government, and here you have the government trying to kick them out now.
Right.
And I think that puts a question of, like, who's next for people with kind of more spotty, you know, living arrangements in the U.S. So it puts a lot of more people at risk. It worries a lot more people. It's insecurity. Uh-huh. So...
I think the reason why this decision was made is because it's Donald... I think President Trump believes that, it's his way of paying forward his campaign promises on being hard on illegal immigration. So it makes him... I think it makes him feel at least as if he's being a more, you know, effective president, because this is his way of sticking it to illegal immigrants. But I think this is pretty obviously the wrong base to... you know, start that. It's not like he's starting with this, but it's just like, this struck a chord with a lot of people. So I think it was, from his perspective, even ill-advised.
Mm-hmm. What's happening with the Trump administration, in that the resignations, the firings, what message does that send? What does that say to you? When you all see, this is, first of all, he never got his cabinet all together in the first place. And he's had so many resignations and firings.
There's a high turnover. Like, I kind of feel like I'm
very
watching
high turnover.
Game of Thrones or something, which is
a little extreme. That's what Al Gore said, yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of, it speaks to inner turmoil, and it doesn't do a lot for projecting a strong and unified national identity. And especially as, like, we're dealing, I don't know, if we're trying to put up a strong face to, like, you know, North Korea, and if we're trying to resolve international crises, it doesn't look very good to have such, you know, turmoil at home.
You all agree. Mm-hmm. How important is transparency? He's always talking about being transparent. Do you think transparency is important?
I think it is very important, and it depends on who the president is, honestly. It depends on how much trust the people have in him, or her, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say that with most of their political decisions, I think the Trump administration has been a little transparent, I think, because it's very social. Now with social media being such a big force, the only thing I can think of that he's really hiding would be, like, taxes or something.
Okay. Well, hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break, but we will return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and their families and other interested folks. This hour we have been looking at what's going on in the political arena. President Trump continues to focus on the wall. In fact, he threatened to shut down the government if he did not get the monies for the construction of the wall. Where do you sit with the wall construction? And people can't see your faces.
Yeah, I think it's a bad idea. I think it's an impractical idea, but it sounded very nice as, like, you know, a rallying point for the campaign, and I think it's like he made it such a central part of his presidential bid that it's something that he has to deliver on, or he will, like, his base will explode, and there won't be any way to defend against that. So I think he's getting a little bit desperate in attempting to make sure that occurs, because it probably will not. Like, I think that it's like the amount of capital that you would have to invest to build something like that, and I don't think it would do very much either for border security. So I think he's kind of boxed himself into a corner.
Do you all think a wall would be effective?
I'm not sure if it would be effective or not. I mean, lots of other countries have walls and fences. Like, for example, Hungary set up a fence on its southern border. I'm pretty sure Bangladesh and India have a fence spanning their entire border. I don't know how effective the fence would be. I couldn't say. But with a fence comes armed guards. With a fence comes towers. I mean, there's a lot you have to put into it. And also, it's indicative of something else, that America is, you know, having its rift with Mexico. And I think that's a big deal. Like, Trump is talking about rescinding NAFTA, which is that's a huge deal. And Mexico, like, simply they won't have it, you know. And I think that that's something that should not happen, because Mexico is such one of our biggest trade partners. Mexico is one of our biggest allies. in this hemisphere. And it's just we're two nations that have cooperated for so long, and just to have this like come between us, and Trump come between the two nations, it's kind of crazy, honestly. So I don't know.
Well, talking about crazy, what about North Korea?
That's a cool segue.
You know, what's happening with North Korea? I mean, it seems like Kim Jong-un is paying Trump no attention at all. He's doing exactly what he wants to do. He's continuing to test his missiles. Mm-hmm. Trump responds with lots of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't follow through on anything, you know, so it's a lot of talk.
I'm kind of happy that he's not following through, you know, with fire and fury at this point. That would be, you know, a little much. I'm trying to go to college. You know, I want the world to still exist. But I like the fact that imagining North Korea with a hydrogen bomb that they say they're capable of mounting on an ICBM would be very scary. And because I know that could reach like...
Well, why can't they? I mean, if the United States can have one and all, how come they can't have one?
I think there's a large differences in the stability of the even.
Well, now can you say that?
Yes, I think that there. Even though the executive branch is in disarray right now, I think that there's infrastructure and, you know, like safety checks that are present within the United States that are completely absent within North Korea, and
they haven't done anything.
Yeah, but they want to.
Trump wants to.
The entirety of North Korea's. I think the way that you maintain, you know, sustain a military dictatorship is by perpetuating the idea that you're constantly on the brink of war. So, and that's what North Korea centered its entire existence on, combating the U.S. and combating the West. And I think that they very obvious, like, they're willing to sacrifice, you know, the well-being of their people in order to supplement their military. So there's a certain recklessness that's present in North Korea that's not present in the U.S., and that's scary.
I don't know. I don't think that North Korea is crazy per se. I don't know what they are. But at the same time, I mean, the same thing, there just needs to be dialogue, honestly. I mean, if you look at the Soviet Union and the U.S., both nations during the Cold War, before they sat down and talked, thought the other was just crazy, you know, with their nukes, and, like, thought they're, like, in constant peril of being nuked. And then what came out of it was dialogue and the SALT I treaties, SALT II treaties, and non-proliferation. So both nations had a mutual understanding that they wanted to exist. And then, so I think that there needs to be definitely a level of dialogue between North Korea and the U.S., and that needs to come about soon, instead of just saying that, you know, and the U.S. needs to be the bigger man in this situation, if North Korea won't. And so there has to be sit down, there has to be talks, there has to be, probably it's going to have to be
diplomacy,
concessions. Yeah. So that North Korea won't spend all its money on its military, neglecting its people, leading to famine, all that kind of stuff. So, I think there needs to be diplomacy between the two nations, and that's the only way you're going to solve this issue.
I totally agree with Keon. But I also think we should take North Korea a little more seriously than we do.
Yeah.
And I know he doesn't look like a serious threat, but if they have a hydrogen bomb, that's a big deal. And maybe not dismissing him, maybe like talking to him at least as an equal, because you have millions of lives on the line. I don't want to go into another Cold War or anything like that. And when Trump said fire and fury, it's not poised enough. It's not dignified. That's how I respond to my brother when he eats the last slice of pizza. Like, no, this is a nuclear bomb. Please take him more seriously. I think that's what needs to happen.
I don't think that from Kim Jong-un's perspective, I don't think that he's crazy. I think he's doing everything that he can to stay in power. And to do that, you have to perpetuate a myth of that like the West is constantly, you know, out to get you, and Donald Trump is doing a very good job of feeding into that myth. So I think he, in that regard, he needs to watch his rhetoric. But it was a hard backpedal that he was trying to do. But he did offer he did offer to meet with Kim Jong-un, or a representative from North Korea, mm-hmm. Diplomatically. I think he wanted to send Nikki Haley, and she made a plea to the Security Council, trying to facilitate something similar. And because there was maybe a couple of week period where they were, you know, North Korea was right. quiet, and now we know that they were preparing for this. But like there have been attempts to resolve this diplomatically, and I think what the U.S. is going to have to do is basically kind of like what we did in the Cold War, is reconcile the fact that North Korea has those weapons, and that'll sucks, but that'll give them a bit of, you know, not a bit of like a large, you know, that'll give them traction to actually gain some concessions. And I know there's an impulse to say like, oh, well, we should just impose more economic sanctions to really, you know, to really stifle their military programs. But that's only hurting the people of North Korea, because mm-hmm. I know that, I mean, I don't know. I assume I have no firsthand experience. Yeah. Very few people do. But like the UN regime consolidates all of their resources into propaganda and into bolstering themselves. So even, like, I don't think economic sanctions are necessarily the way to go either, because you're just going to hurt a starving population.
Let's look at Charlottesville for a few minutes, okay? In response to Heather Heyer's death, Trump stated that both factions were at fault. You know, he praised the Nazis and white supremacists, and he said that they were very fine people. Again, protests arose across the country. In response to this, what's your comment? How'd you read it? I mean, what message was he saying? If he's saying, and it was pretty clear, at least from the view of the television, that the white supremacists seems like they really did initiate all the problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, they yeah. went there prepared mm-hmm. for combat, okay? Mm-hmm. For the president to, you know, go on the air and say that they were, you know, there were some good Nazis and some... Yeah.
I mean... I kind of feel like that was a softball, you know? But it's really not funny, though. I know...
No, it's not.
I was in the library at Rickards, and a teacher was talking with students about how to deal with how to reconcile your president, you know, like perpetuating or at least defending white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And... It's not an issue that I ever I don't know. I thought, like, it's 2017. Haven't we left that behind? Which is a foolish mentality to have. But, like, I think that most, you know, Americans can, you know, come to the conclusion that even if you are a good person, if you're standing within a group of, like, very enthusiastic neo-Nazis and very enthusiastic... members of, like, outright members of the KKK, mm-hmm. then you cease to be a fine person if you continue, like, celebrating with them and continue, you know, like, at least associating.
What was he saying? If he's going to take that position, what is he saying? Who does he represent?
He knows that that's his base. So, like, he doesn't want to anchor his base.
I don't know if... neo-Nazis exactly are his base, they're I'm sure they're part of it, but not the biggest part. Yeah, but I don't know the neo-Nazis, they started the protest in Charlottesville, I think, and there was an anti-protest mm-hmm. against them.
Indeed.
From the
yes,
yeah. And so, and then, you know, she ended up dying. Correct me if I'm wrong, the white supremacists had guns with them.
There was an armed militia that was,
yeah, yes. There you go.
Right.
I think it's peaceful, right to peaceful protest, and I mean organized protest that's peaceful. I think that's kind of, you know, that's overstepping their boundaries. And you know, just like representing their militancy, to reach their aims, even if they didn't. I mean, they ended up killing a lady, not with a gun, but they still ended up killing a lady. And I think that was kind of, you know, out of the blue, you know. That was also, you know, a big overstep. But at the same time, I know that a lot of the anti-fascist protesters, they can oftentimes be just as bad as the white supremacists. And I think that when you lose civility, you kind of lose justification in your cause, and you lose face. And it can be hard to, like, find ground with who's protesting. So I think that it needs to, you know, stay organized, they stay civil. And there's no point in trying to make inroads and promote your cause when you're being overtly militant or belligerent about it. You're not going to get anywhere. Even if Donald Trump does say they're upstanding people, it doesn't matter if the majority of people think they're not, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. But what I find it hard to distinguish which, if he said nothing, like, he waited a long time to give out a statement, and what he said. I don't know which one would have been better, honestly. I completely disagree that, maybe I'm biased, but I just am not a fan of white supremacists. if he said nothing, and if he, and blaming it on both sides, I think both things are completely horrible things to do. And I think that says a lot about him, and I'm pretty sure most of us knew that.
Okay.
I guess I do agree with Keon in the fact that I think that I think on the whole it's pretty easy. No, I think it's pretty undebatable, I guess, to say that the counter protesters, I think, behaved in a distinctively less bellicose way than the protesters, but. And I also think that when you're delivering a statement to the nation after, members of white supremacist groups, you know, like killed a member of a counter protest, you have to consider what both sides are fighting for. And though I think that the counter protesters could have handled themselves a bit better, you have to look at what both groups are standing for. And I think it's very, very bad to try to establish some sort of moral equivalency, because I think that you can't use ambiguous knowledge, not ambiguous knowledge, you can't use ambiguous wording when you're dealing with hate groups. I think that you have to very distinctly, you know, decry them. And I don't think he did a good job of that.
In these last few minutes, there are a couple of things that continue and have been happening. Recently, a nurse in Salt Lake City was arrested. Are you aware of this?
Yeah.
For doing her job. She refused to draw blood on an unconscious patient, and that's the protocol here. Are we moving? What's happening? Are we moving to a police state? I mean, she was arrested. Do you think that Trump and his attitude has any impact on this?
I don't. Okay. I think that this was a case of police officers making the wrong call, and I think that I'm actually pretty confident in the fact that due process will be carried out and that they'll be punished, because I like.
Well, he's apologized at this point.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that the officers involved were in the wrong and that the nurse was in the right. So I think that this is something that we have effective mechanisms in place to resolve.
Okay.
The problem that I don't get is, where do these officers get their right to do things like this? And I'm glad that a woman was able to come out and tell this. And I'm glad that there are videotapes, and I'm glad that...
Oh, that makes a big difference today, doesn't it?
And even if the state does nothing, social media will usually take care of things like that. And I'm... Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's a counterweight, and I think I'm at least happy for that. And if no one's going to fight back, at least that'll help.
Okay. An interesting observation is that Trump continues with his pugilistic attacks of the media. I don't expect you to respond to it. I just, you know, want you to think about that, because we'll get into that next time. To my listening audience, thanks for the privilege of your ear and your time. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.